Hello and welcome to the Organic Research Centre podcast. My name is Vicky Smith. The Organic Research Centre, or the ORC for short, is an independent research charity working for better and more sustainable farming systems which promote the environment and provide good food for everybody. This is one of many podcasts which we will be recording to help celebrate our 40th anniversary throughout 2021.
Yes. So how did I get to meet Lawrence? How did that happen? Well, I was, as I said at the time, I was at the Center for Tropical Veterinary Medicine, and I was actually in Kenya seeing animals as part of the research projects that I had at the time when the outbreak broke out. And you know, having discussions with people in Kenya about the nature of foot and mouth disease control and the use of vaccines, that's just been part of the work that I've done. So to come back to the UK and to find that quite a lot of colleagues were volunteering, joining Ministry of Agriculture, going off to become the farm vets chasing around after cases of foot and mouth disease, you know, I really sort of scratched my head when I looked at the scale of what was happening. And trying to understand what could I contribute in this situation. And at the time, seeing almost no discussion taking place about the alternatives to whether there really was anything else that could be done. And I think what particularly affected me was the arguments that appeared that said, well, vaccines are, you know, don't work. There are plenty of histories of cases in the literature where foot and mouth occurs in vaccinated animals. And I thought, yes, it's just like our experience with cars. You know, we didn't stop driving cars when we found that they broke down. You know, we understood each of those what was wrong and set about trying to find a way to use vaccines in an effective way, conscious of what they give, what they can do, and their limitations. And there's been such a volume of European literature, South American literature on the use of vaccines, because it was very much part of the way that Europe eradicated the disease. So suddenly we had this sort of situation. I had master's students who were asking as well, to understand this situation and observing almost every day the disease control changing and becoming in many ways more drastic and with less clarity about the rationale for it. And I think when it got to the point of saying that sheep within 3 kilometers of an infected farm would all have to be slaughtered, whether they showed any signs of or not, that I think, you know, a lot of us as veterinarians, especially if you have any experience of this infection, would say, you know, it's very hard to conclude that that is the only way of dealing with it. Plus, we're dealing with special breeds as well, in many cases in the Lake District, that are really adapted to their hill conditions, have been there for bred for generations, and we're going to lose those in this setting. So that sort of led me really to say, well, you know, there are issues with vaccination, particularly the economic ones we talked about, but there's also a lot of science that says we know how to use them, we know their limitations, we know how to test animals after vaccination, not perfectly, but we can detect the difference between an infected animal and a vaccinated animal. This needs to just be said somewhere an economic case might be the right one to justify but it's not the case that vaccines themselves do not work. And I was in the situation where really no academic was at that stage willing to sort of go public. And there were some instructions that this is so sensitive, so political, that really to keep out of this. And for that reason, I decided in the end to write a letter to the Daily Telegraph under a pseudonym, just setting out some of the key facts that would mean that that vaccines should not be ignored completely in the discussion of disease control.
Yeah, by this time we were pretty desperate because we had we were aware that something horrible was going wrong within government. But I was friendly with some high up officials within MAF, and I was hearing all kinds of stories about internal battles, about management of the process, who was giving advice, who wasn't giving advice. It's now a matter of public record. There's been several publications about this, scientific publications talking about how this policy was managed. But basically, the story is that the veterinary epidemiologists who were within MAF, within Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food, were effectively sidelined or questioned by an external team brought together by the overall government chief scientist at that time, Dr. David King. And he and a colleague in the Royal Society brought in some modelers. What this meant was, modeling's great. In some cases, you have to do modeling. There's no alternative. But what goes into the model and what comes out is critical. What goes in, the quality of the information. And it became clear, we took the view that as things went further and further, that the quality of the models were losing track of reality. Keith talked about the 3-kilometer cull. We thought it was already a problem before we got to that point. And we realized, we took legal advice and realized that we could on this basis seek a judicial review of the policy, because we argued that they had not taken into account all factors. They hadn't weighted all factors proportionally and had not gone through the process of due diligence and due governance, which is what was the basis of our judicial review. But in order to make that case, we needed expert opinions. And we brought together a case. We did bring together a case on historical management, history of the disease and how it had been managed throughout the world, which a researcher called Abigail Woods produced. We produced an economic case for against the extended cull and for vaccination, which Peter Midmore, who was an agricultural economist at Aberystwyth, produced. But we were missing the core argument for the scientific case for vaccination. And I could not get anybody in the alternative world to stand up. And they would all tell me privately, the case for vaccination is very clear. You can do it. Vaccines exist. And I could not get anyone to put their name to it until I read the letter from Dr. Green, who turned out to be Keith, would persuaded Keith to join our team in helping to put together the case for judicial review. And that's how we set about it, with financial support from Peter Kindersley. Why Elm Farm Research Centre got into it is because we thought this was wrong from an organic perspective, but increasingly we thought this was wrong from everything you look at in terms of animal welfare, the health of rural communities, the health of farmers, that this was completely, totally wrong, totally against our principles. And we felt we just couldn't stand back and let this happen. Once we started, then other people came forward. So, for example, the National Trust, who were concerned about the hefted sheep, the herd wicking in the Northeast, in places in Cumbria and so on. So others came forward, but and then belatedly other organisations within the organic sector. But we still needed this core scientific argument that Keith was providing, and in a very difficult position within his institution and his employment.
Well, I think it's interesting. I got to the point where I was a total despair about the lack of scientific and economic arguments to weigh up and to be discussed. And it felt far, far too easy simply to say, well, the vaccines won't work. Did we have enough vaccines? That was a relevant question, given the millions of animals that potentially would need to be vaccinated if you take a very wide approach. But the actual question, would vaccines stop the transmission at local? Would they obviate the need to cull animals immediately in a huge panic situation that we had? Would they allow some heat out of it so that we could actually take a more measured approach? All of those things subsequently, those options for the use of vaccine have been shown by both in terms of modeling and logistical planning that what we were saying at the time was absolutely borne out by the later approach to the use of vaccines. Use them in a targeted way. If you're too targeted, you end up with just a few farms that are vaccinated. They don't want to be alone. And what we found in our discussions then was farmers really wanted to be together. If they were in an area, they didn't want to be the only ones vaccinating. They needed to know that they had what would happen to their animals and what would happen to their milk, what would happen to their business. So we're trying to answer as soon as we put together an information basically saying, vaccines do work. It already depends on whether you can manage the economics so that farmers know going into vaccination that they're not going to be pariahs for years afterwards, that there's going to be as good an option, preferably better than slaughtering and replacing, which is for some of those special breeds and high genetics, is just not an option that would be anyone could take. So basically I sort of wrote for Lawrence this piece hoping that it would just put into the public domain sets of papers, sets of arguments that anyone could read, anyone could download and find, hope that would be enough. But the idea of let's say going to a judicial review, this was something that I've never had any experience of before, and I was quite amazed in the processes to see this, sail up apparently to the to the High Court, and at the same time to be getting the highest level of attention it would appear in government, which led to Lawrence and I being invited to a meeting, which I will never forget.
Yeah, we got a call late at night from Downing Street asking if we could go and meet the Prime Minister. The next day, the next morning, Keith was in Edinburgh. He flew down early next morning. And the two of us were shown into this waiting room where Keith was brought face to face with some of his previous employers and some of the senior researchers who were there to defend their position. And it was a kind of rather uncomfortable little wait in that anteroom. We then were shown into the cabinet room where Prime Minister, several ministers, Minister of Agriculture, Prime Minister's advisors were all arrayed around the cabinet table, and we were making the case. And we had this, I'd say, difficult meeting. Meanwhile, our just judicial review is still going through the courts. There was a subsequent meeting a few days later in which Blair did finally agree to take a decision to start vaccinating animals in Cumbria. It was a Friday. We were winning the judicial review process, but because Blair had promised us that vaccination would start on Monday, we withdrew at the last stage from the judicial review. Peter Kindersley still had to pay the money, which was a huge, huge amount of money. You have to also remember that the general election had already been postponed because of the foot and mouth crisis. So we withdrew, and then over the weekend, Blair was lobbied again and reversed his decision. So vaccination never happened, and the contiguous cull and the other culls continued. But the mood had changed, I think, in the country, and there was now a real swing wanting to know why vaccination wasn't happening. And as far as farmers were concerned, whereas for a long time farmers had just been accepting this fate, they began to say no. And our legal team set up a helpline advising farmers on to how to prevent the slaughtermen going onto their farms. And in that way, I don't know, a huge number of farmers were prevented their livestock being killed. And then, you know, vaccination receded into the background, and more and more animals were killed. And as Keith reminded us, the foot and mouth continued until from the spring until the 30th September 2020.
Yes. But I think there were so many, many things about that same day. I mean, it was extraordinary to be there in central London at the same time having a meeting with you and the Prime Minister and his advisors, and at the same time having the judicial review, you know, taking place. Very clearly a sort of critical moment, really, in terms of exercising all the minds concerned. And I do remember one of the Prime Minister's advisors asking me, saying, how is it when we go on the web and we find that we've got a research centre, our own flagship research centre, Purbright Institute, global expertise in foot and mouth vaccines? How is it that I have to turn to this meeting with you to be able to get this kind of advice that we need when we go there and we find that they're doing all this research on vaccines to improve them, to make them ready for emergency situations like this? And I think that sort of understanding at the heart of government that you know, there's on the one hand, you know, a set of contingency plans, economic arguments that relate to, which have their own logical basis. And at the other time, that there are things which can work, but we choose for economic reasons not to use them, not for scientific reasons, but economic, largely economics and logistics. You know, that was I think that had some sort of powerful long-term impact. I'm not sure that the sense that the Ministry of Agriculture and its positions and its how it and the guidance that it was seen to give was always in keeping with the need to protect the vulnerable tourism industry, the everybody else who lives and uses the countryside, the ability to walk. So it was very much a forerunner of COVID, because essentially most of the countryside was under lockdown and you couldn't anymore use it to cross footpaths, for example. Sporting events were closed. They were in fact closed, like the Cheltenham races. They were closed for foot and mouth disease, and they weren't closed at the beginning of COVID. So, you know, there were really huge impacts on the non-farming community. And the question was, you know, when we add it all together, is it justified to work largely on the basis of emergency planning for one sector when then there's a whole of the rural society, in fact, the whole of the UK economy was affected by that, what was taking place.
Keith, can you tell us a little bit more about the modelling? We've touched on it a little bit earlier in this podcast, and I think as well in the previous podcast. Can you give us a little bit of background?
Modelling was an attempt to say, what does it happen in the real world? But at the same time, the modelling of vaccination is based on a logistics of how quickly can you supply it? And what I was providing at the time was also a history that in different countries, the rates of vaccination differed enormously. I think the calculation in the UK was about 8,000 animals could be vaccinated a day. Whereas in Uruguay, affected at the same time, they were vaccinating over 250,000 animals a day. Now that's logistics and a question of using farmers and their support rather than individual trained vaccinators. So they're being ready for, but you know, our arguments were largely on the basis of understanding that there is some choice, but it is actually going to be difficult whichever way you choose. It's going to be some really difficult ways. If they had used vaccination as we thought they might in some areas of the country, it probably could only be certain places like the highly dense dairy populations of Cumbria, where they might have had the level of vaccination, and maybe in Devon as well, sufficient for those ones, at least to start with. But those were where the real calamities were taking place, and where the exhaustion, both of the rural population and also the whole veterinary service to be able to deal with it, plus the millions of carcasses that were piling up, you know, that could have been to some extent managed in a different way, bringing in vaccine. So now I think what we've learned from it is we'll always need models to make decisions which are really difficult. But in the end, the decisions are going to be based on, as far as possible, doing it in advance to identify the areas in particular where a vaccine would be merited, or other areas where the livestock density is sufficiently low, separation between farms is sufficient that probably there'd be negligible benefit to vaccinate. So really focusing attention on certain places and giving a very clear pathway to be able to economically ride out through and maintain the income of those farms that were vaccinated. And I think if you remember, Lawrence, there was a controversial time at that moment, because in European legislation, there was a possibility of compensating farmers who did receive, let's say, disease control measures that would affect their income. You know, rather than just compensating them for dead animals, you could compensate them if they were part of disease control measures that were for the public benefit. And that could have applied to the question of those farms receiving vaccine. But that was a route that nobody had apparently really worked out how to sell the case to the livestock farmers or the NFU.
So what would happen today? I mean, would trade considerations be paramount still, or you know, could we ever have that mass cull again? Would that happen now if the same situation happened? Have the rules changed in some way, the trade rules?
The trade rules, so basically one of the big implications immediately taking place after UK 2001 was the complete prohibition on swill feeding to pigs across Europe as a result. And we could say that, that's never really been reopened as a possibility. So that was to turn off the kind of entry point as far as possible, so that if you're importing, if there's illegal imports of meat, for example, which are infected and they go through and they end up in being fed to pigs, you know, that could not be a legal route to do that. It would all be essentially illegal if it happened. So that turned off one of the possible entry points. Then there was the change to the rules about how long animals need to stay on farm before. That was a UK decision to ensure that you couldn't move them on and then move them off the next day and keep moving them on, which would be one of the reasons that seeded so much movement of infection around the country. So reduce that potential amplifier of markets leading to mass movement and bed and breakfast, as it was called, you know, sheep staying overnight and then moving on. That might reduce the size of an outbreak. But, you know, there are still some possibilities that huge outbreaks could still happen. But So if we can reduce the risk of a huge one and keep it to something which is relatively small. So the UK outbreak, the last one in 2007, was in an area with a relatively low density, which is in Surrey. Even there, it took, I think, the best part of 2 months to sort of manage it because of all the tracing needed. So even a small outbreaks without vaccines have a length and duration that sometimes has the major impact rather than the number of animals killed. So it really depends if you want to get your international trade back moving, including the use of products to go in, you know, milk products and so on, then those things will still come up as a potential problem. Internationally, the benefits of, you could say, of such a severe shock to the UK and Europe, because it wasn't just the UK, it was also, it spread to Ireland, it spread to France, and there to Netherlands, was that, you know, all of Europe had to think about this. And a lot of other countries were asking, could it happen to us? And so they really wanted then to relook at the international trade rules and say, you know, are we being too negative about the use of vaccines? Could we safely reduce the time after vaccination when we could regain our trade status? It's never been equalized so that you can say that there's no difference between using vaccine or not using vaccine, you know, and keeping the animals alive. If you vaccinate and then say, you know, everything's gone quiet, that's good, kill all the vaccinated animals. This is what happened in the Netherlands. You know, that still has, of course, you know, very, very severe implications for those livestock owners who would have to basically look after vaccinated animals, knowing that there will be, you know, they will be slaughtered. So there was a major review, and I think the essentially opening the questions that we did together, bringing that into a debate, wasn't just with the Prime Minister's office. That debate raged around the internet in the UK and more widely once it became known that, you know, there was a real debate to be had about the tactical use of vaccines. It's not the vaccine itself, it's how you use it that matters. Mm. And what you do to protect the income of a sector after it starts to use vaccine. You know, that became the sort of mature discussion, but sadly that took place largely during the reviews, which were occupied, you know, most of 2002, I think, European Parliament, you know, Royal Society reviews, multiple reviews took place.
Thanks both. And as we're drawing to the end of the podcast, I wondered whether there was any last things that you wanted to say or mention that maybe we haven't covered previously.
I was going to say a couple of things, really. I mean, one is that, you know, the sheer volume of people needed to do the disease control operations, mm-hmm. very unpleasant, often very, very arduous conditions. Veterinarians slaughtering, having to euthanize healthy animals, that had a long-term psychological impact on many veterinarians. And now we're in a situation where obtaining such a source of people to go and do that work would be an enormous difficulty to resource. I mean, I know DEFRA will have its contingency plans to do it, but, you know, the view that most veterinarians have is that their job is really about animal welfare and about animal health. And it brings that tension up inside an individual about doing something which they understand is for the society, when their instinct is to do the opposite. And I think that will mean that there would be ever more vigorous debate if we launch into a slaughter policy that isn't really arguably the very best thing we could do at that time. And the second thing I'd say is, you know, COVID has taught us that what we used to say about vaccine nationalism for foot and mouth disease, every country keeping its own reserves to be sufficient for its situation, seen the same with COVID, that you know, a reliance on your neighbor to provide you with vaccine doesn't work when your neighbor is also worried about getting it. So in the end, the you know, we learned a lot, but we also learned that that preparing for these massive impacts of epidemics, you know, really has to have society with you if it's going to bear the cost on the personal liberties as well as the incomes of the many. So I'm not sure that we could see another 2001 again.
Yeah, I just, and as far as organic research centres concerned, that the fact that a small independent research institution was brave and stubborn enough to step outside of its sort of role within a tiny sector was due to the fact that the Elm Farm Research Centre staff were completely behind what we were doing, because they saw that opposing this policy, this slaughter-only policy, was entirely in line with organic principles and the ethics and values of how organic farmers and the organic movement deals with animals, and also the role of farms in society. We could do that because the staff got behind the principles. I had a trustee body who were brave enough to follow, and I had people who were prepared to put up the money. But we had, you know, it existed because we had the vision that we weren't just a research centre. We were involved in changing society. Our business isn't research. Our business is changing the world. And I think an independent research centre still needs to have that overarching vision and know when it's time to step outside the box and step up.
That brings us to the end of the podcast, part one and part two. I hope you found them both informative. Thanks to Keith and Lawrence for taking part in the podcast. If you would like to find out more about the ORC, whether that be our research, knowledge exchange or policy activity, please visit our website. I have included a link in the podcast introductory information to our homepage. You can also follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook or LinkedIn, as well as signing up to our bulletin or e-bulletin via the contact part of our website. Please also keep checking our 40th anniversary webpage for the latest celebratory content, including podcasts, webinars and research fact sheets, which will look back on some of our most pioneering research over the last 40 years.